environment, in fact, practically all of us. And so what it requires is a bit of a context as to what the environment was at that time. And to understand that, we need to understand just a little bit of history of how things were at that time. So contemporary historians, they write, non-Muslim historians, they write that if one of the first words that came into the English language from the Indian Sanskrit is the word loot. Like, so we say looting is going on in downtown. That's actually from a word that those who know Urdu and Hindi are used to using. They say loot mar ho rahi thi, right? This word is very common. And it came into the English language. And to understand, the historians say, well, why was this one of the first words, loot, to come into the English language? From why did that happen? They say to understand that you have to look at a castle that is based in the United Kingdom in far off Wales. It's called Powis Castle. And this castle was where one of the employees of the East India Company that managed to gain control of India was, he eventually moved all the treasures and all the money that he had earned to this castle. He bought this, and this is where he put Mughal artifacts and treasures that were looted from Muslim dynasties. And so much is there to this present day in that castle. So many Mughal artifacts and treasures are there that there's more in that one castle in Wales than in any one place in India. Even the National Museum in Delhi doesn't have as many Mughal artifacts as that one castle in far off United Kingdom does. So that gives you an idea of how much treasures were looted from the Muslim dynasties and Mughal dynasties and transferred over. And so that gives you a context of how things were. In fact, in that same castle, they have and they took the tent of Tipu Sultan. Tipu Sultan is a very famous figure. His tent was displayed there and it was used for garden parties. So it was used as an object of colonial dominance, that this is how much control we have. This is what we think of your civilization. The tents of your rulers are going to be the marquees and holding areas of our garden parties. So this was not something that was a coincidence. It was a clear indication and an ishara that this is what we think of your civilization, and we are the masters now. We are the owners now. And it belongs to us now. But this looting, in fact, is kind of like, if you understand, brothers and sisters, is like how a mosquito works. Like, you know, some mosquitoes are non-disease vectors. What they do is that they come, they bite you, and then you have some irritation, you have some itching, they suck some blood, and that's it. So it's painful, it's irritable, but it's not that deadly. Like, it doesn't kill you. And so you can kind of understand looting in that context, where just like a mosquito drains a person of his blood or takes blood out, this is how the East India Company and the colonials were working, is that they were looting treasures, transferring them, and impoverishing what was one of the richest societies. And taking all this wealth and transferring over, impoverishing the local population and taking power away. That is bad, but it's not as bad as what came after that. So we said that some type of mosquitoes are non-disease vectors. They bite you, they draw the blood, it causes irritation, but in the end it's okay, you'll live. But some mosquitoes are disease vectors. So they're not only drawing blood, but they're transferring pathogens over to you. They're transferring viruses over to you. So they're transferring, for example, the West Nile virus. When they bite you, it's not only that they're taking blood, they're giving something to you. And it's not a gift. It's poison, it's something that's bad, it's a virus, it's a pathogen. It's something that is going to cause you more pain. It's something that is much more dangerous than taking away from you. So this is how they started to operate. Why and when did they start to operate in a vast capacity was after the uprising of 1857, when the British eventually gained control back and they started going after and mass slaughtering people. And scholars were hanged. And seminaries and madaris were shut down. They were auctioned off. And this is mentioned, even non-Muslim historians mentioned this, that madaris and seminaries, these buildings, they started to auction them off. Took over them and started auctioning them. So much so that the madrasa of Shah Waliullah, Madrasa Rahimiyah, was also sold off. And some of these were demolished, some of these were used as a store and storage. And so they no longer functioned as seminaries and institutes of learning. That whole purpose was gone. And madaris were shut down. Because the British saw the hand of the Muslims behind the 1857 uprising, and so they wanted to take revenge. And so even in Delhi, this economic and shift of the power went from the Muslims, it moved away. And they no longer had that control. And this background, what they wanted to do was just like the mosquito, what we said, we have the disease vectors where they're not only taking from you, but they're giving you. What they wanted to do is give ignorance and spread jahala. Because jahala is a disease. Just like the West Nile virus, just like the dengue fever, just like malaria, ignorance is a disease. Ignorance is an ailment. Ignorance is a sickness. And it's established from the kalam of the Prophet ﷺ in a hadith, narrated in Sunan Abu Dawood, that is authentic, that an incident happened. And the Prophet ﷺ mentioned, فَإِنَّمَا شِفَاءُ الْعِيِّ السُّؤَالِ, that the cure for a person who doesn't know is asking those who know, asking the ulama, learning. And so the ulama, when they mention the sharh, the explanation of this hadith, they mention that the Prophet ﷺ used the word shifa. The Prophet ﷺ used the word cure. Shifa means cure. Why did he use the word shifa? Because they said ignorance, not knowing, not having knowledge, is an ailment, is a da, is a disease. And the dawa for this da, da means ailment. The dawa, the cure, the medicine of this ailment is knowing. And how does one know? One knows by inquiring and asking those who know, from ta'allum. So a person learns, a person asks, a person seeks knowledge. And by seeking, he cures himself with the will of Allah Azza wa Jal of this disease of not knowing. So what were the British doing? That they were not merely satisfied with looting now. So looting was already occurring, but they transferred to a new phase, that now we want to spread disease. What kind of disease? The disease of ignorance and jahala, to take away the knowledge that the Muslims have. And how do you take away the knowledge that the Muslims have? You shut down the seminaries. You go after the scholars. You take away the institutions of learning, and you take away the men of learning, and then the people have no guide, and the people have nowhere to learn. And so ignorance continues to spread and compound, and then slowly, slowly people move away from religion. So this was, in summary, the kind of background of what was going on in colonial India at that time. And things took a turn for the worse after 1857, when all these madaris were then being shut down, demolished, and sold off. In this background, the ulama met, and they said that they decided that there's going to be a madrasa that we're going to establish. And they said, well, where are you going to establish this madrasa? In a small town, in Deoband, far away from centers of learning? How and where does that make sense? And how is that going to contribute to the revival of deen in India, and so on? This is something, if we step back, brothers and sisters, is something called a black swan moment. A black swan is something that they define as, in the ancient Roman words, that they would say a bird that is so rare upon earth as a black swan, because people only knew white swans. They never saw a black swan. So this became a saying for something that happens so rare. It is so unpredictable that it's a black swan moment. That the Romans, that they coined this term, that a bird so rare upon the earth such as a black swan, because they had never seen a black swan. And so this became a statement. If something was so rare, something was so unexpected, it would be called that this is like a black swan. And how did that term came into being? That when the Dutch, when they went to Australia, they found out that there is something as black swans. So the whole knowledge of what people knew, that no, there's no such thing as a black swan, was turned upside down. And so it came to be used as a term recently, as something that happens that is so unpredictable that people don't know about it. It's unforeseen, basically. And it has a huge impact on people. It changes people in a huge way. And then in hindsight, people go back and say, oh yeah, That could have been predicted. That could have happened. So these are the three characteristics that recent authors say about this is what a black swan event is. What is a black swan event? It's unpredictable. In hindsight, people say it could have predicted it. And it has a huge impact. And this is what Deoband was. It was a black swan event. It was something that could have not been foreseen. Because just as we mentioned, after 1857, when the madaris were being shut down, the seminaries were being closed and demolished and auctioned off, and the ulama were being hanged, you wouldn't expect that from the depths of that destruction, an institute would rise that would have so far-reaching effects that it would reach Europe and the United States. You couldn't have foreseen that. Because the Muslims had lost all political power. The system of the madaris, a lot of them used to work on the system of patronage. You would have awqaf. And so the wealth of the Muslims was being looted, like we said in the beginning. And you didn't have people that now would be able to, well, I want to sponsor and I'm going to make waqf of this place and this is going to be the serve as the madrasa. Those things were being eradicated piece by piece by piece. And so in that kind of environment, when in Chatta Masjid in Deoband, they got together under the shade of a pomegranate tree and started the madrasa of Deoband, nobody expected that it was going to rise from here. Nobody foresaw that. That from this institute, you're going to have an institute that is so innovative that it would turn this old system of patronage upside down. How so? They were no longer going to go through and have go to one rich person is going to sponsor this madrasa or this place, and that's going to be a waqf. But rather, the people as a whole are going to crowdfund this madrasa. And so you have one of the founders who takes a handkerchief, turns it into a pouch, and goes in the local vicinity and neighborhood and starts collecting donations for this madrasa. So 2 rupees here, 5 rupees there, small, small, tiny donations that will lay the foundation of crowdfunding this madrasa. And nobody would expected that, because that was something that was simply not done. That the madrasa was going to run in this way, shape and form. And so when you look at this situation, at that point of view, at what the Muslims were, you expect that there is no way that this madrasa is going to rise in this way, in this situation. So totally unexpected. That the madrasa was going to have an organized curriculum. Later down the line, it was going to have exams. It was going to be done in an innovative way. It was going to later on have its own buildings. And so that kind of innovation was something that was not foreseen by anybody. It was something that did not just have a mere human hand in it, obviously. And inshallah, we'll get to that. The madrasa was also innovative in the sense that by seeking public funding, by seeking funds from individuals instead of from one or two rich people, people had a stake in that madrasa. They had a sense of belonging to that madrasa. They had a sense of belonging to that institution, that I gave my few cents to this place. I have a stake in seeing this place prosper. That kind of connection that the mashayikh of Deoband connected the people with was something that was unheard of. And then they wrapped this all up, the curriculum, the funding, the process, in a system that was easily scalable and you could replicate it anywhere. It didn't require that it needs to have one rich or two rich person that has to have this same motto and this same thinking in another place. That same system, you could take it and replicate it in another place, and replicate it in another place, and replicate it in another place. And lo and behold, what started in 1866, after the madaris and seminaries were decimated, branched into dozens and dozens of madaris in decades. A system that was exportable. To see how, understand how powerful it is, if you look at the premium institutions of learning in the Islamic world, in Fez, Qarawain University, in Egypt, Cairo, Azhar, you see that the model is based on you have to go there to learn. You have to go there to learn. And so it's one institute or affiliate institute, but you have to go there. With Deoband, they realized that for the Islamic revival to happen, it needs to be everywhere. And it needs to be a model that can be easily replicated. Person graduates, becomes a scholar, they can go back to their town, they can go back to their country, they can go back to their city and replicate the model and start it. And the model was exportable. You could adapt it to your country. You could adapt it to your region. You could adapt it to your land. And that's why you have, if you go to the United Kingdom, if you go to South Africa, and you see, we're sitting in one right now. These madaris were exportable in the sense that the concept could be easily replicated. That kind of innovation was so different and so amazing that nobody saw all of this coming. And that's one aspect of it. So that fulfilled the first condition of being a black swan. Nobody thought that a madrasa is going to rise that's going to give birth to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of madaris on the same level. And you're going to have, it's going to be the way for preserving Islamic identity. Top of that, what counters what is Aum said, if you look in the reports of the madrasa, you had non-Muslim children coming to the madrasa. Hindu children coming to Darul Uloom Deoband. That is so strange. Darul Uloom Deoband was a purely Islamic institution. Its whole purpose was preserving the identity of the Muslims. The whole purpose of Darul Uloom Deoband was to preserve the identity of Muslims now that the madaris and seminaries have been decimated. Why would the non-Muslim population of Deoband, the Hindus that were living there, choose to send their children to a purely Islamic institution? They were learning Farsi, Persian. They were learning basic arithmetic and math. Look at the trust and faith that the non-Muslims had in a purely Islamic situation, that we trust our most precious possessions to send our children to a purely Islamic institute so they can learn something. Flies in the face of all the propaganda that's out there, isn't it? That Deoband is like this and Deoband is like that. If you go back, and this is historical accounts, you can see. More amazing than that is if you look in the accounts, they have an account of who donated what. Because they have this, so-and-so donated this much coin, so-and-so donated this much rupees. You have the names of non-Muslim in the donation list. So this kind of model, that could you foresee that a purely Islamic institute is going to be there and non-Muslims are going to choose to send their children to that madrasa so that they can learn some basic knowledge that they wanted their children to know? It's an amazing aspect of it. And it contradicts all the propaganda that has recently come up in India and elsewhere about what Deoband is and what Deoband is doing. That non-Muslims would donate to this madrasa, that non-Muslims would send their children to the madrasa. The population that was living there, that most intimately knew what this madrasa was, what function it served, what purpose it served, would choose to send their own children to that madrasa. All this points to one amazing thing, that this event, this madrasa, this movement of Deoband was a black swan event. Unpredictable, huge impact, a global impact. In hindsight, people go back, well, obviously, you know, madrasas were decimated, so a new madrasa was going to be founded. Well, it's easy to say now. But at that point in time, when Muslims were at that level, when madaris were decimated and scholars were being hanged and this kind of funding model was implemented and this kind of curriculum was implemented, standardized, and this was the process that was done, that you would see it rise to that global level. And so that's what's so amazing about it. There was a black swan event. And in fact, Deoband, in kind of countering the propaganda of having non-Muslims study there and non-Muslims donating to it, is not something ajeeb and ghareeb. In fact, that is how Muslims have been, that non-Muslims trust the Muslims with their children, like in the case of Deoband, and with their holiest places. And I divulge just for a second, because this is such an important point, because Deoband is at the center, the propaganda that is pushed, because Deoband is no longer a movement that is restricted to India. It is a global movement. And so Muslims globally are inspired by that. If you go to Al-Quds, or if you read about Al-Quds, the holiest site in Christianity, the holiest site in Christianity, according to them, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, sepulchre is spelled S-E-P-U-L-C-H-R-E, where different denominations of Christianity are used, that church. The keys of that church are in the hands of Muslim families. The keys of the holiest site in Christianity is entrusted to Muslims to open the door of the church. Can you imagine giving the keys of the Kaaba to a non-Muslim? Muslims have no political power in Al-Quds. So why do the Muslims are still entrusted, why are they still entrusted with the keys of the holiest site in Christianity? Imagine what kind of trust the local population, the non-Muslim population has in the Muslims, that they're interested in opening the keys, opening the door of the church and closing the door of the church, the holiest site in Christianity. Don't believe me? Google it. Google who has the keys to the holiest site in Christianity. Because the different denominations, they're going to argue. The reason is that they argue over who's going to have this. They say the Armenian church will say, well, no, we want it. And the Greek Orthodox will say, we want it. And the Catholics say, we want it. Say, okay, we'll just give it to them. The Muslims will continue to have it. They'll open and close the door for us. A neutral party. Give it to them. And this is part and parcel of what Deoband is. That it's an organization that is there for, we as Muslims, we have three basic responsibilities. One, our own personal selves, our own ibadah that we are responsible for. Our salah, our siyam, zakat, hajj, so on. That's restricted to us personally. Then on a community level, we have our masajid, our madaris, our institutes, our publishing institutes, our dawah efforts, that is there to preserve that Muslim identity. And that is what Deoband did. And then on a level beyond that is to be of benefit to the community beyond that. Amongst the countries that we live in, amongst the people that we live in, the non-Muslims that are there, to be a benefit to society as a whole, on a higher level. And you see that these children coming, being accepted into a madrasa that is there to preserve Muslim identity, they're welcome with open arms. And not only that, they are writing it in their annual reports that we have non-Muslim children studying at our madrasa, as to tell the entire Muslim population in Hindustan, in India, that we are not, this is not something that we're hiding, we're openly saying this. And we're welcoming who wants to study with open arms. And so, you see, Deoband went beyond that, what we said, the second level is to preserve the Muslim identity, and then beyond that, to be of benefit to the local community. And that is what Deoband is. So if you want to understand what is Deoband, it is, yes, it is there to preserve Muslim identity. That is the primary basis of it. But that does not discount the fact that it is there to benefit community and society as a whole. Because an individual that comes out of a madrasa, that understands what trust is, that understands what responsibility is, that understands what truth is, that understands how mu'amalat and business transactions are done with honesty, this person is going to interact with non-Muslims. This person is going to have trade dealings with non-Muslims. This person might be partner with a non-Muslim in tijara, in business. He's going to use that knowledge that he has to be honest in his transactions. He's going to use that knowledge that he has to be fair, to be mutually beneficial to the partner that he has. So Islam is, this whole concept is there not only to benefit the Muslims, but benefits the society as a whole, because it takes out, it graduates individuals who understand what it means to be a good person in society, what it means to be a decent human being in society, what it means to be an honest individual in society, to look beyond a person's own interest, self-interest. How can I make more? How can I take away from him more? No, it teaches the person that you have to be fair. You have to, doesn't matter the person on the side, on that side, on the opposite side, is a Muslim or non-Muslim. You're a businessman. You're a trader. You have some sort of financial dealing with a person. Whatever you're doing, you have interaction with that person, you have to be fair. You are a neighbor. You have a non-Muslim living next to you. They have rights over you. What are those rights and how do you react to that? All these aspects were being taught. That is why with Abdullah ibn Mubarak, there was the home of Abdullah ibn Mubarak being sold. I'm sorry, the home next to Abdullah ibn Mubarak, the celebrated jurist, was being sold. His neighbor was a non-Muslim. And the person was asking double the price. Right, so let's say the homes around a neighborhood are, let's say, in regular dollars, 300,000, 400,000. This person is asking 800. So you say, this is preposterous. The square footage of your home, homes around you, the comparable values are 400,000. You're asking $800,000. Why? He said, in the language, he was asking 2,000. He said, I'm asking 1,000 for the home. I'm asking 1,000 to be a neighbor of Abdullah ibn Mubarak. You're not going to get that opportunity again. So I'm commanding a premium because I'm living next to him. So a non-Muslim knows the value of that. That's what Deobandhu is teaching. You have individuals that understand what it means to be a decent human being because they understand what is the ilm behind it. Now, being a black swan event does not mean that some sort of help, some sort of inspiration, some sort of progress was not expected. The ulama, the awliya, they expected and they were asking for some sort of, that there should be some means of preservation of Islam in India after all what happened. They just didn't know what form it was going to take. They just didn't know how it was going to look. That is why Haji Imdadullah, the Sheikh of Maulana Qasim Nanutwi rahmatullahi alayhi, when somebody went to him and said, we have established a madrasa in Deoband, please make dua for it. Now the person obviously didn't mean that, you know, it was all our effort, all our resources. But as it is with the awliya of Allah, they, with the saints of Allah, they always want to correct the persons and provide a source. Look carefully where you're looking at. The person said, what to the Haji Imdadullah, the Sheikh of Maulana Qasim Nanuti, one of the founders of Deoband? We have established a madrasa in Deoband. We want you to make dua for it. Haji Imdadullah says, subhanallah, you say we have established a madrasa in Deoband? Subhanallah, you say we have established a madrasa in Deoband? You don't know how many countless souls were making sujood at pre-dawn, making dua that, oh Allah, make the means for the preservation of Islam in India and make the means for the protection of knowledge in India. You don't know how many people scattered across were making this dua at the time of tahajjud, making dua when duas are accepted, again and again pleading to Allah Azza wa Jal that look what, ya Allah, make the means for the preservation of Islam. He corrected the person's statement so that it would serve as a lesson for all of us. He said, this madrasa is the fruit of that dua. This madrasa in Deoband is the fruits of the duas and the supplications of all those people that were making dua. Here is the crystal difference, respected brothers in Islam, between leadership and the prophetic model of leadership, imama. The difference between leadership and the prophetic model of leadership, imama. In leadership, a person is only look at the resources. This is what I have, this much money, this is what we can buy, this is what we can do, these are the resources we have, these are the teachers we have, this is what we can do. Imama looks beyond that. The heart is in full reliance upon Allah Azza wa Jalla. That's the prophetic model. That is what the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam taught us. And so this was a lesson from Haji Imdadullah that no. Just to be clear, Deoband is not the result of just tangible resources. It is the result, it is not just a mere human endeavor. This is much beyond that. This is hours and hours of supplication and pleading before Allah Azza wa Jal, and this is the answer to those du'as. And the author of the biography of Maulana Qasim Nanutwi rahmatullahi alayhi mentions this, and then he mentions the example is the example of Badr, the Battle of Badr, where the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam saw the pagans, the mushrikun, were 1,000+ in number. You all know that Muslims were 300-some in number. There was a huge disadvantage in terms of equipment and men. And the Prophet ﷺ was already promised by Allah Azza wa Jal victory and nasr. In spite of that, there he was in his tent making dua. It's merited in Sahihain. Continued making dua in the narration of Sahih Muslim. The Prophet ﷺ is making dua, making dua, making dua. Abu Bakr is quietly behind. So much so that the rida, the chadar, the sheet of the Prophet, the upper sheet, fell off his body, off his Mubarak body. He's towards the Qibla, hands raised, pleading, 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 pleading. You can imagine the fervency of that dua and supplication, that the rida fell off his Mubarak body. And at that time, the Prophet, the Abu Bakr came, picked it up and put it back on the Prophet. He put the sheet back on the Prophet and hugged him from behind and said, you have beseeched your Lord sufficiently. He will fulfill his promise to you. The Prophet ﷺ had already knew that victory was promised. The heart knew that, but the body had to fulfill its haqq, its right, which is ibadah and worship, and ad-du'a mukhul ibadah. Du'a is the essence of worship. As an example, and the ulama have said that the Prophet ﷺ did that, Imam Nawawi mentions in his commentary on this hadith, that to show to the sahaba, to give an example to the Sahaba what to do, and by niche, and obviously by extension to all of us, that your resources are small, your resources are large. Whatever you have, whatever you're doing in life, personal, on a community level, whatever you have, it's never going to discount the fact that your heart needs to be reliant upon Allah Azza wa Jalla. That's the prophetic model. You are a father, and you have a lot of knowledge, and you're going to give good tarbiyah to your children. You have all the resources, mashallah. You understand Arabic, you understand the books, you understand everything. Doesn't negate the fact that you have to rely upon Allah Azza wa Jalla. You have very little resources. You reverted to Islam recently. Your resources are little. You say, what am I going to do? How am I going to preserve? How am I going to help my children learn about Islam? What am I going to do? You use the resources that you have when your heart is reliant upon Allah Azza wa Jalla. The condition of the heart doesn't change in terms of the resources that you have. That is what is being taught to us from the elders and the mashayikh of Deoband, that whatever resources you have, whether you're doing it at an individual level or whether you're doing it at a community level, that doesn't take away from the fact that you have to rely upon Allah Azza wa Jal. We, respected brothers, elders, mothers and sisters in Islam, within our own personal, in our homes, when we're doing tarbiyah of our children, foremost among our mind always the question is, how do we preserve Islam for the future generations, especially in this environment? How do we do that? You use the resources that you have, but the heart doesn't shift away from relying upon Allah Azza wa Jal. We as a community, we talk about our masajid, our madaris, our institutes. We realize, how can we continue to benefit our community and preserve Islam as an identity, as a population as a whole? Whatever resources we have, no matter how much or how little they are, we use the resources we have, but the heart doesn't shift away from being reliant upon Allah Azza wa Jal. We mentioned that in Deoband, how they went beyond that, and there were benefits to the community at large. Whatever resources we have, it doesn't stop here, but we are people who are by nature have an obligation to be beneficial to society. Just by not, if at the very simplest level, it means by being fair to the people that we interact with, that we buy from, that we trade with, that we do transactions with, that we live alongside. And this is also what Deoband tells us and shows us, that there is a way to be a decent neighbor, that there is a way to be beneficial to the community. And so it flies in the face of all the propaganda that is out there. So this is, respected brothers and elders, the basic framework of what Deoband did. And there you have all these madaris that are there. If you go to practically any city where you find masajid, where you find madaris, where you find institutes of learning, you will find somebody that has learned at an institution that has Deoband as its inspiration. It's such a common thing that it's almost unexpected to see where you go to an institution, you go to a city and you find masajid and you say, well, there's not a scholar that has been schooled in the Deobandi way here. It is something that is very rare. And so that model is something that was totally unexpected back then. Why? Because it combined these two things. It combined both the resources and it combined being reliant upon Allah Azza wa Jalla in the prophetic religion. This is something that was, it's so simple to state, it's so easy to state, but it's something that requires an effort of the heart. Respected brothers, we came out of the month of Ramadan and many of us were making i'tikaf. Many of us made sunnah i'tikaf, many of us nafal i'tikaf. It was staying in the masjid, right? It was staying in the masjid. This model of Deoband is saying that the heart has to make i'tikaf, a permanent i'tikaf. Permanent i'tikaf in the hereafter, where it's completely, the heart is seeing at a totally different level, and the body and the eyes are seeing at a totally different level. When we as individuals in a community move to do that, that is when the community really shines. That is when the help and the of Allah Azza wa Jal comes. Because now you've negated all your own resources. You have shown your faqr and poverty. You have shown your ubudiyah. You have shown your servanthood and slavehood to Allah Azza wa Jal. That whatever resources we have, it doesn't matter. How smart I am, how wealthy I am, how much I have. And this applies across all levels. So this is something that whether you have ever studied in a madrasa or never studied in a madrasa, if the first time you're hearing about Deoband or if it's the 100th time you're hearing about Deoband, we can all have that takeaway that we take away from us, that the heart needs to meet i'tikaf in the hereafter. That is there, that is always seeing with a vision different from what the body and the eyes. The body and the eyes have its own obligations that we take into mind the resources. The Prophet ﷺ took into mind all the resources, how they should be positioned, what resources we should have, how Badr should be. And then compare that with the Fatah of Makkah. You'll see the similar reliance upon that there is no switch in the position. Their 300, their 10,000 doesn't make a difference. The resources can be vast applied across. That's if you want to see a vast difference, see, compare Badr to the Fatah of Makkah. You'll see that the heart doesn't change. And as a community, when we do that, then we apply this prophetic model of imama, of leadership, how Deoband applied this prophetic model of imama, of leadership. And the second takeaway from this is that how they used innovative things that were not thought of before. Standardized curriculums, exams, decentralized crowdfunding, anything that is permissible within the daira of Islam, within the circle of Islam, anything that is permissible, that is jais and permissible to do. Islam isn't stopping you from doing it, from achieving better results for ourselves, for our society, for our community, to preserve our knowledge, to benefit the greater society as a whole. But it has to be within that circle. And so it's not like they hung fast to like, no, we're going to do it the same way that is done before. Well, they said, well, this is, we're gonna do this model of crowdfunding. People have to be connected to this institute. People have to think that they have a share in this institute. And it has to be something that is completely independent. So one person or two person or three person is not able to dictate how this madrasa or this institute should run. Rather, it's done, it's the entire community has a stake in it. The ummah has a stake in it. Because it is for the ummah by the ummah. And so we can apply that same model. It's whatever new innovations that might be, as long as it is within that daira of Islam, as long as in the circle of Islam, as long as you don't transgress something that is go beyond what is permissible, you are encouraged. Do whatever you can that is beneficial to yourself, to our community, and to the greater society as a whole, that benefits Muslims, non-Muslims. You are encouraged to do that. That is a second takeaway from Darul Uloom Deoband, that you should be innovative. You should be coming up with new ways of helping Islam and Muslim, as long as it doesn't leave the circle of permissibility. As long as jais. And how does that find out? You consult the ulama. We went going back to that same thing, that this this disease of ignorance can be cured one way. How the Prophet ﷺ told us that same hadith, that فَإِنَّمَا شِفَاءُ الْعِيِّ السُّؤَالِ, that the cure for not knowing is inquiring. You ask, this is what I want to do. This is my method. This is the method that I want to propose. Is this beneficial for my family? Should I do this? Somebody may be able to tell you, yes, this is a beneficial way to do it. Oh no, this is against Islamic laws. You shouldn't do this. And that's it. It's not rocket science. So these two takeaways, respected brothers and sisters, if we can go with this. One, the prophetic model of imama in everything that we do, in our own personal lives, as murabbis, as parents, as brothers, elders, community volunteers, larger community as our madaris and madrasas and the people that are in charge and given the responsibility and the masooliyah of running these, and on a personal level and a communal level, and then whatever innovation that we can do, whatever new things that we can do, as long as it doesn't leave the daira of Islam, as long as it's something that's not impermissible, well, if it helps us become a better community, if it brings in, you know, it helps us preserve our Islamic identity, if it helps the society as a whole better, then it's encouraged. And that is what Deoband did. And with that, inshallah, I hope that and that this was beneficial. May Allah give us tawfiq. Anything that was good is from Allah Azza wa Jal. Anything bad or a mistake was from myself. Wa astaghfirullah min qawlin bil amali. Jazakumullahu khairan.